It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. economy added more than 200,000 jobs in March, despite another recent rise in interest rates. We'll talk to a Wisconsin economist about the latest numbers and what they mean for our day-to-day finances. First, you may have run across the name Ozempic lately. It's a drug used in the treatment of type 2 diabetes. But it's seen a growth in off-label use as a weight loss medication. Some doctors are prescribing it that way, some people are shopping for it that way, and a related drug called Wegovy has been approved by the FDA for weight loss. But there are a lot of open questions about who should and shouldn't use these medications. So, we've got a UW doctor who's an expert on diabetes treatment and research to help tackle some of these questions. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this diabetes medication, Ozempic? It's used for diabetes or for weight loss. Do you use it for either purpose? If you work in healthcare, are you getting a lot of questions about this right about now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Dawn Belt Davis is the director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center and professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She's also section chief of the endocrinology at the VA in Madison. Dr. Davis, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Can you talk about Ozempic, first of all, in its originally intended use for treatment of type 2 diabetes? What does Ozempic do?
Sure. So Ozempic is a brand name for the generic drug name is semaglutide. And this is part of a whole class of medications. There's actually several different types of medication in this group of therapies. And the way these drugs work is they were designed to treat type 2 diabetes, and they work by mimicking a hormone that your body makes naturally. So they're mimicking a hormone called GLP-1. And this hormone GLP-1 is normally produced by your body in these hormonal cells that in the gut, and it helps to regulate the way you process food by stimulating the release of insulin. So it helps your body to create more insulin and clear that blood sugar or blood glucose from your system. It also has some effects on promoting slowing down of the emptying of the stomach and promoting the feeling of satiety or feeling full after you eat a meal. So all of these things have positive benefits for patients with type 2 diabetes and additionally can promote some weight loss as well.
For people with type 2 diabetes, is the current state of affairs, hey, if you have type 2 diabetes, you should be taking one of this class of drugs, or is this just selected patients or very few? How commonly used is this?
I would say they're quite commonly used, and their use has really been increasing over the recent years for a few reasons. One is that, again, more and more of these drugs have been making it to market, and they've become easier and easier for patients to take. So, for example, Ozempic is a medication that, although it is an injection that patients have to take, they only have to do the injection once per week. So that really makes it convenient and easy for patients to use. And additionally, drugs in this this class, they have some additional benefits beyond just lowering blood glucose levels or blood sugar levels. As we mentioned, they also promote some weight loss. They have been shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease outcomes, and also have some potential benefit in kidney disease in patients with diabetes. So we're using them more and more in our patients with diabetes, both to help manage their blood sugars, but also for these additional benefits that they provide.
Now, I'm guessing that this isn't the only thing somebody with type 2 diabetes might be doing. There might be other medications or lifestyle changes. Like, I'd love there to be a miracle cure, Dr. Davis. I'm assuming it isn't just this, though?
Correct, right. I mean, so this is just one part of our, one kind of tool in our toolbox that we have to treat our patients with type 2 diabetes. Lifestyle changes are always kind of the cornerstone of our treatment recommendations, but we know that lifestyle changes lifestyle changes alone are often not enough to really fully adequately treat patients with type 2 diabetes. So they often need medications in addition to lifestyle changes. And those medications can include all kinds of things, medications that have been around for decades, newer medicines like things like Ozempic, and then we also use insulin quite commonly in our patients with type 2 diabetes as well.
For Ozempic and other medications in this class, side effects, what kind of side effects do people sometimes see?
Sure. The most common side effect with drugs in this group is nausea and vomiting, and sometimes some other stomach upset like diarrhea or bloating. That happens pretty commonly. I would say up to 30% or more of patients will have some nausea and vomiting with this drug. And that's really the most common thing. We also do worry a little bit about potentially rare complications with this drug, including some patients do seem to have an increased risk of something called pancreatitis, which is inflammation of the pancreas. And we also see a slightly increased heart rate in patients taking these medicines, which isn't a big deal for a lot of people unless they already have a problem with, arrhythmias or other problems with their heart.
Talking to Dr. Dawn Davis with the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center, looking at Ozempic and other drugs in its class, used more and more commonly for people with diabetes, helps with glucose, as we've heard, helps with weight loss for people with diabetes. And there it is, a lot of people interested in that weight loss aspect of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions. If you've explored using this drug for either or both purposes, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Davis, Ozempic and other drugs in the news as people look at them as a possible weight loss use. How do you evaluate people saying, okay, I don't have diabetes, but I would like to lose weight. Maybe I should check these drugs out. What kind of things should people be thinking about?
Sure. So the same drug, I mentioned the generic name for Ozempic is semaglutide. And the same drug, semaglutide, is actually approved for weight loss in patients without diabetes. And that drug is marketed under the brand name Wegovy. And Wegovy was approved in summer of 2021, specifically for the treatment of weight loss. And so there are options to use these medications for patients without diabetes to help promote weight loss. The issue really has been around availability, and the Wegovy, although it was approved in 2021, it really wasn't available due to a lot of manufacturing issues and shortages. And so that really limited the use of Wegovy, and a lot of patients switched over to just using Ozempic, which is truly the same drug. It's just packaged and marketed in different doses and different ways. But that impacted the availability of Ozempic for a lot of patients who were using it for type 2 diabetes.
Now, with any medication, from aspirin to Zyrtec, you're trading off benefits and risks and costs and possible side effects. Is that calculation different, Dr. Davis, from someone who's seriously overweight to the point where that's causing direct health threats versus, say, a Hollywood actor who wants to keep off 3 or 4 pounds for their next role? Does that calculation look different?
Absolutely. And so, we don't recommend the use of these drugs for weight loss for patients who are only, who are not actually clinically overweight. These medications are approved for patients with a body mass index greater than or equal to 30 or a body mass index greater than or equal to 27 with some related medical problem. So no, they shouldn't be used in people who maybe just have a couple extra pounds to lose and are not actually clinically overweight. Like anything, there are potential risks and side effects. And so there should be a health benefit from that weight loss that offsets those risks and side effects. And, if you, again, don't have clinically meaningful excess weight to lose, then we wouldn't recommend the use of these medications.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Anne is with us in Madison. Anne, hello.
Hi. I am type 2 diabetic and I'm clinically overweight and was prescribed Ozempic and had high hopes for it. But after I took my second dose, the left side of my tongue just ballooned, swelled way up. And I had to go to urgent care and get an antidote. And then they took me off it. I can't take it because of the side effect.
And thanks for calling and sharing that story. I'm not a doctor. We can't diagnose over the phone. Of course, Dr. Davis, it sounds like some kind of allergic or other reaction. Is that something we commonly see with drugs in this class?
You know, we don't see a lot of allergic reactions, but they certainly can happen. And that's a perfect example of, you know, that any kind of medication we're using, there is always a risk of a side effect or an allergic reaction. So it sounds like in this case, it was an appropriate choice to try to use this medication, but it may not be safe for everyone. And the other thing I would point out too, is that these medications aren't effective 100% of the time. If we look at the clinical trial data, you know, about 75% of patients taking these drugs get the expected benefit, but about 25% don't really respond. So it's not necessarily the magic bullet that we would hope it would be.
And thanks again for sharing your experience. I'm glad, I'm sorry that this didn't work out for you. I'm glad you shared your story, though. Dr. Dawn Davis is with us, director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center. We're looking at this diabetes drug, Ozempic, and related medications. They're getting a lot of hype as weight loss aids. We're checking out the pros and cons, things to think about, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been hearing about this drug at the Oscars from your friends? Are you or someone you know using it to control diabetes, to try to lose weight, for both? Have you had trouble getting it if you use it for diabetes? We'll talk about issues with availability. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Dr. Dawn Davis, director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center, looking at diabetes treatment and weight loss and a prescription medication called Ozempic and other medications in the same category. You can join in if you have questions, maybe an experience to share using it, dealing with patients who use it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Josie is with us on the way to Iron Mountain. Josie, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm asking actually for a relative who's morbidly obese but not non-diabetic. Would this be appropriate, and is it covered by insurance?
Josie, thanks for that call. Dr. Davis, I don't know if you heard with that connection, a relative obese, Josie says, not diabetic. Might this be appropriate, and would it be covered by insurance?
Yeah, that's thanks for the great question. Yes, these are drugs can be helpful for patients, like I said, with obesity who don't have diabetes. It is important, though, I think, to recognize that, you know, even best case scenario, sometimes patients on these drugs will lose 10, maybe 15% of their body weight. So although that's great, it's not necessarily going to be the dramatic change that some people are looking for. But we do know that 10 to 15% of body weight loss is great in terms of helping improve your metabolic health and your overall health. So even though it may not be the cosmetic outcome people are looking for, it can still be very helpful clinically in improving their health. In terms of insurance coverage, that's another great question. I think these medications are sometimes difficult to get insurance coverage for. They are very expensive, they are new, and they are injectables. And insurance companies will sometimes cover them for diabetes, but not for obesity. And sometimes they will cover them for obesity, but only with very strict criteria. So it can be challenging to get insurance to pay for these medications.
Josie, thanks a lot for those questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Davis, you mentioned that the Wegovy had some availability problems. I've been seeing reports that Ozempic, people who rely on it for diabetes might have trouble getting it because of a surge of interest from people interested in it solely for the weight loss side of things. Is that something you've heard about from your colleagues or encountered yourself?
Yeah. So I think, you know, we don't know exactly where the shortages are coming from, but yes, there have been shortages of Wegovy and Ozempic over the past year or two. And they've been pretty severe in that we literally could not even get these drugs for a period of time. And we had to switch patients to other medications in many examples. I think, you know, the thought is that some of that might be driven by people taking it what we sometimes call off-label, like for reasons where they may not necessarily have a clinical need for the drug. But I think it's also being driven by just increased use in patients with type 2 diabetes and obesity, and just overall supply chain problems. The real concern I think we have is that, you know, if there's a drug that is in short supply, we certainly would want that drug to go to the patients who need it the most and not to the patients who don't necessarily need it clinically. So that's where the use of it, you know, by celebrities to lose that 5 pounds comes into play, that if they get the drug and my patient with type 2 diabetes does not, that's kind of the problem.
Talking to Dr. Dawn Davis, director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center, professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the diabetes medication Ozempic and some of its relatives, getting a lot of hype for use in weight loss. Still time for your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Davis, I want to talk about duration of use. I assume somebody who's treating diabetes with something like Ozempic is going to keep using it for quite a long time. Someone might hope with weight loss to lose X number of pounds and then stop using it. Does it work that way, or is there a problem if that happens?
Right. So I think the issue is that if you discontinue using these drugs, most likely patients will regain at least some of the weight back. We don't have a lot of data really to look at that discontinuation phase. We do know that with discontinuation, often we see weight regain with most of our medicines for weight loss. So in type 2 diabetes, yes, we typically would have a patient remain on this for an extended period of time until either they, you know, don't tolerate it or have some other reason to stop it. For weight loss right now, the idea is that yes, patients would stay on it for many years, which again gets to be an issue in terms of cost and other, you know, potential concerns with long-term exposure to side effects, et cetera.
And Dr. Davis, I wanted to ask, you treat people with diabetes. You also do research. What kind of things do you have your eye on for the future of diabetes treatment?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that are, you know, things that we're really looking forward to. I think that we have really grown a lot in terms of our ability to treat type 2 diabetes over the last 10 or 15 years. We have a lot of new drugs that we can use, but unfortunately, one of the things we're still lacking is things that get at kind of the root cause of diabetes and are really helpful in prevention. So some of the work we're doing in my research lab and others is trying to find ways to help the beta cells, which are the cells that make insulin, you know, grow and survive under the kind of stressful conditions of obesity and diabetes, with the hope that if we can promote that, we can keep insulin production ongoing in patients who are at risk of diabetes and hopefully prevent it or certainly make that diabetes less severe in the long run. So that's one of the things we're working on.
Time for one more caller. Lou is with us in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Lou, hi.
Hi there. I was calling in regards to a question I had with the Adderall. I am having, the Ozempic would make a difference for me too. I mean, I'm a diabetic, but Adderall, and I don't know what it is, but it's and I've been on this stuff for 25 years. I'm 70 years old, but it is totally dried up. Everywhere I go, I cannot find it in any pharmacies, whether it's way down south or way up here, the big Walmarts, the Walgreens.
I gotcha. No. Lou, there is an Adderall shortage out there. I know, Dr. Davis, I don't know if that's what you've been following. And Adderall not usually used directly for diabetes. I understand it could actually make it a little tricky to treat diabetes. Do you have thoughts for Lou?
Yeah, I mean, right. Adderall is not something we use for the treatment of diabetes, but it's just one example of many, many, many examples of drug shortages that we've seen over the last several years. You know, I mean, we always struggle with drug shortages. I think the pandemic made things a lot worse over the last few years, but it's really an issue. A lot of times patients really struggle to get medications they absolutely need. And, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are often, you know, doing the best they can, but things come up and we really struggle with how best to manage this. Ideally at a national level, we'd have a way to kind of, again, allocate and move resources around so patients could access things that they need.
Thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Davis, bringing things home to our conversation about Ozempic, diabetes, and weight loss. As you've mentioned, these are still, in the scope of things, fairly new drugs. What are some of your big unanswered questions when it comes to the use of this class of drugs, both for diabetes and for weight loss?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the big unanswered questions I think we have is going to be understanding, you know, if, are there some reasons why certain patients respond well to these medications and others just don't have the same response? That's certainly something we're interested in and that we've even been looking at on the research side as well. And I think the other thing, as we talked a little bit about too, is, you know, are these drugs something that we really need to keep patients on forever to continue getting the sustained benefits? Or could we perhaps do some sort of short-term treatment and then maybe a retreatment in the future? These are all very open questions that we need to answer as we move forward.
And Dr. Davis, I've been at this in the media for a while. It seems like miracle weight loss products come and go. Some are scams. Some turn out to be not that useful. Some are harmful. It sounds like Ozempic has some promise, especially for people in more dire states, but it's not the miracle weight loss supplement that people might be hoping for. Do I have that about right?
I mean, I think so. It's certainly one of the best we have available and one of the best we have had available. And I'd say the overall side effects are good. Like the safety here is a lot better than some of the other medicines we've had in the past. There's a new medicine that just got approved this summer called Mounjaro, which works kind of similarly to Ozempic, but it has some additional things. And it's really got some amazing data in terms of weight loss. It's not yet approved for that indication. It's only approved for type 2 diabetes, but that's another one that I think, again, moving forward, we may see some really compelling numbers there that help, you know, increase the use of these medications overall. But yeah, they're not, we're still not at the magic bullet, you know, point where we can promote, you know, 100 pounds of weight loss with a single drug.
Dr. Davis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Dawn Belt Davis, director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center, professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, and section chief of endocrinology at the VA in Madison. She joined us for a look at the diabetes medication called Ozempic and why it's being used as a possible weight loss drug. Coming up after the news, we look at the latest national job numbers and what they could mean for the Federal Reserve's next move on interest rates. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a lot of plastic in our clothing, and a lot of that ends up in the environment, one way or another. Find out about the impact of the clothing we wear and why there may not be easy solutions to some of the problems. Now, the U.S. economy added 236,000 jobs in March. That's slower than job growth in February, but it's still seen as a healthy number, especially after recent rises in the interest rate. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates 9 times over the last year in an effort to slow down high inflation. New numbers on inflation during March are expected to come out tomorrow. A Wisconsin economist joins us now to look at the latest news and what it means for us at the store, on the job, at the gas pump, and in our job searches. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're looking for a job, have you been able to find them in your line of work? If you're an employer trying to hire people, what are you seeing? Have you noticed prices for things you buy at the store going up, down, staying the same lately? Are you buying or selling a house? How's that going? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your personal observations, or your economic questions. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Yamin Ahmad is professor of economics at UW-Whitewater. Yamin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
A lot of pieces of the puzzle here. Let's start with those job numbers. Unemployment rate in March, 3.5%, pretty close to a 53-year low. Looks pretty good. What do you make of that that job report from last month?
I mean, it's still, the data is kind of showing that the, at least in the labor market, the it's still pretty healthy and pretty strong, that businesses are looking to hire workers, and there's quite a lot of new jobs being created every month. And so typically, again, we tend to think of anything above 200,000 jobs a month as a sort of like a indicator for a fairly healthy economy. And that's, you know, if we get above that, that's great news. So on the labor market front, at least, there's big demand for hiring workers, and new jobs are being posted all the time.
There's a lot of good news, bad news going on lately, Yaman. Yeah. So, okay, great job numbers. Hold on. What about inflation? The Federal Reserve kind of wants those job numbers to go down a little bit, I think. So when you see good job numbers, what does that make us and maybe make the Federal Reserve think about inflation?
Sure. So the Federal Reserve has this dual mandate. So part of what it's mandated to do, there's two things. One is to stabilize prices and inflation, and the other thing is to try and achieve maximum employment. So when we look at the job numbers right now, as you mentioned, it's an unemployment rate net across the country is about 3.5%. When we kind of compare that to what we call the natural rate of unemployment, or if you kind of think of it as like a long-term unemployment rate, that number is a little bit higher at about 4.5%. So that means we're currently doing pretty well because our current unemployment numbers are below that long-term average, if you will. And so from the Federal Reserve's perspective, as part of its mandate that it's doing pretty well on is the unemployment side. So its concern and its focus has been pretty much on trying to bring inflation down. And given the numbers that we're seeing, you know, obviously I'm not in the room that they, when they decide these things, but, that, you know, they have about a 1% point, 1% gap there that they can sort of utilize to try and bring inflation down as much as possible. So that's kind of the what we call the policy space that they have, that they're working with. And their thinking is sort of that, you know, they can try and bring inflation down. There may be a little bit of a rise in unemployment, but it'll still be hopefully below that. They'll hopefully keep it below that natural rate of unemployment, this kind of long-term unemployment number that they're aiming for. So the Fed never actually explicitly says what unemployment numbers it said it is going for. The inflation number, the inflation target is pretty well defined, but the unemployment target is a bit more vague, which gives them a little bit of room for discretion. But that's kind of typically what we think of as this this long-term unemployment rate is kind of what they would like to be at or under that. So for them to sort of succeed on that part of the mandate. So yeah, everything that they're trying to do is kind of focus on inflation at the moment, given that the labor market seems to be doing pretty well.
Let's talk about inflation rates now. We were, you know, dancing around 10% for a while there. That number you were talking about that the Fed wants is, I believe, 2-ish%. Well, split the difference. We're like right in the middle of that 6%, watching for a number tomorrow. Predictions are it might be a wee bit lower. Still kind of stubborn and trying to get to that 2%, though.
Yeah, and that's very true. I mean, so when, you know, in my own work and others, that we kind of found that inflation in the U.S. tends to be very persistent, meaning that, you know, once if inflation ramps up, it takes a really long time for it to come down, even with monetary policy trying to bring it down. So in many ways, you can kind of think of that as, you know, going from 10% to 6% has been the easy part. Going from 6% down to that 2% you're mentioning, it could be a lot harder because inflation will kind of tend to stick around because of a bunch of different factors, because of the fact that, you know, when we look at when businesses change their prices, it's not all together at once in response to what monetary policy is doing. That's kind of staggered over the course of the year. But there are other factors that can you know, lead to that persistence that we see from, what's happening with wages, but also what people are expecting to happen to inflation. What we call inflation expectations can actually be a big driver of actually what drives the inflation process itself. So it's a large part of it is the Fed's still got their work cut out for them in terms of trying to get down to that 2%. And again, given the current framework that the Federal Reserve uses is something called average inflation targeting. They're trying to get to a 2% average over some period of time. So as long as the average of inflation has been 2% over some period of time, then that's, they're kind of considering that they've met their target for there. So I would expect inflation numbers to slowly come down. But as you know, John Williams and others who are on the committee are saying that it's still a road ahead to try and get to that 2% that they want to aim for.
We are talking about the economy, the big picture stuff with Yaman Ahmad, professor of economics at UW-Whitewater. Love to hear how you are experiencing all of this. Is there something important to you that you buy on a regular basis where the price went up? Has it come back down? Are you looking for a job? Are you offering jobs? What does that look like right now in this economy? Oil production cut a little bit. Are you seeing the impact of that at the pump lately? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your personal economic report. Oh, yeah, mortgage rates on houses. You looking to buy a house now? Things are a little different than they were a few years ago. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Yaman, the Federal Reserve, one of their tools is to set interest rates. That sort of indirectly changes what people pay when they borrow money, including to do things like buy houses or cars.
Yes.
How is that affecting us right now?
So, as you also said, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates, and we're up to just under 5%, right? The particular interest rate that they target is something called the federal funds rate, and all sort of like other interest rates are sort of tied into that Fed funds rate measure that the Federal Reserve tries to change. And so one of the things that we've seen is that obviously over the past year or so, mortgage rates have obviously gone up quite a lot. We've seen interest rates on credit cards go up and other loan rates that that banks and others typically charge, they've all sort of increased over time. So the idea is that the Federal Reserve, by changing interest rates, by adjusting interest rates, they're trying to make it more expensive to borrow. And in trying to really slow down the economy and slow down spending and try and get to taming inflation that way. So that's sort of broadly the process of the Federal Reserve, how it works in terms of when it implements monetary policy. But unfortunately, one of the things of that is that that process is also very slow. So, all the interest rate hikes that, happened over this past year, they're starting to have an effect. And as you see inflation coming down, the impact of all those interest rate rises are still in many ways to be felt down the road. I mean, you could still be looking at the end of this year before the full effect of what happened last year, materializes. And so the Fed also sort of plays this guessing game in some ways, not in terms of trying to assess what's currently happening with economic conditions and whether they need to keep raising interest rates. They try and make forecasts for where the economy will be. And so that's kind of where they are right now. They're trying to they raised rates quite aggressively last year, but those rate hikes have kind of have slowed down a bit, in part because the Fed is trying to see how much of an impact that they have on the economy and do they need to kind of keep raising rates more. I would expect at the next meeting that they probably will still raise interest rates. But we'll see what the data comes in tomorrow and the output numbers that are coming in at the end of the month, the preliminary estimate for the first quarter, what kind of impact it's having. And, the Fed obviously looks at all this data before making the decision.
So let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hello.
Listening to the guest here, so my comment, I've worked in manufacturing sector for roughly 25 years. And in that sector, I see a change in buying incoming raw material goods away from the Asia market, certain markets in Asia where they typically have lower labor costs, to shift in buying more goods, raw materials from our European partners or sourced locally within the United States, which typically has higher labor costs. And we're seeing higher incoming raw material rates. And I just wondered if you could maybe speak to that, as how you see that translating to whether it's inflation or economic stability here moving
Interesting.
Forward.
Chris, great question. And Yaman, I had seen pre-COVID stories about reshoring, doing some of what Chris was just talking about there, manufacturing and raw materials, trying to source them closer. Then COVID, then the supply chain craziness. Are you seeing companies do more of what Chris is saying and saying, yeah, we want our stuff sourced a little closer to home?
Yeah, I've looked at some preliminary data on that, and there seems to be some evidence of that going on for sure. I think in part that, you know, there's economic uncertainty across the world. And when that happens, you know, you're trying to, you know, leverage that and try and get some, you know, or not leverage, I'm sorry, hedge against that, excuse me, to try and get some degree of certainty in terms of where you can get your resources from. Certainly what Chris was mentioning with regards to like commodity prices and producer prices, they did go up. And I think in the most recent data that I've seen is that when you look at the producer price index, that's actually starting to slowly come down. And typically one of the things that we see is that this producer price index typically, what's the word I want to look at? It moves ahead of the consumer price index, if you will.
Leading indicator, they call that.
Yes, so exactly. So the changes in the producer price index often are a good predictor for what might happen to consumer price index. And so when we see, you know, in the most recent data, I think if I remember, the PPI has kind of come down quite a bit. I think it's down to about 2.37% or something like that. And so, you know, on that basis, I would expect, you know, it to have a downward pressure on consumer prices as well. So, you know, I think a lot of what will happen is that as supply chains reorient themselves, as commodity prices, I mean, there's still shortages and things in certain markets, but they're slowly changing over time. Their contribution to inflation, I think, had a big impact during COVID, but their impact is slowly waning as markets over time clear themselves. So I don't know if that answers your question, Chris, but hopefully I get to what you're asking.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Yemin Ahmad, professor of economics at UW-Whitewater, looking at the latest economic news. There's lots of it, including slower but still healthy-looking job growth in March. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're looking at the U.S. and global economy. You can tell us how it's affecting your personal economy. Job searching for people to fill jobs, buying, selling houses, refinancing mortgages, you name it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Yemin Ahmad, professor of economics at UW-Whitewater. We're checking in on the economy after new jobs numbers and ahead of the Federal Reserve's next policy meeting. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your observations, your questions. Back to your calls now. Adam is with us in Deerfield. Adam, hi.
Hi. Just had a quick question for your guest in regards to refinancing. We were in a variable that started getting very, very high, and we refinanced into a fixed that was also high but at least stable, and we're just wondering if you have a prediction of the future as to when might be a good time to look at refinancing to try to get it at a lower fix.
Adam, thanks a lot for the call. We can't predict the future, Yemin. I feel like there's probably bad news for Adam. I think the only way interest rates are likely to drop a lot is if we have a really bad recession, right?
Yes, that's true. Looking at mortgage rates, I think the 30-year fix, I thought sort of in the recent data, I think peaked at about 7%. That's actually come down a little bit. But I think with continuing interest rate hikes, I think that I'm expecting to happen at least through quite a lot of this year. Really, unless the economy ends up going into a recession, we may not see interest rates really come down. So it's hard to predict because there's a bunch of things that can obviously happen. But certainly, I think for the foreseeable future, I would expect at least maybe even 2 years or more before we start to see interest rates really come down. So I have sort of bad news on that front. I would not expect mortgage rates to really come down significantly unless there is some other external factor that like kind of pushes us into a recession that really starts to, you know, then the Fed might have to kind of think back about the unemployment numbers and reassess there. So yeah, I would not expect in at least for the foreseeable future interest rates to really and mortgage rates to really come down even on fixed term.
Sorry, we don't have better news for you, Adam, but thanks for calling in. Now, yeah, I mean, Adam, not the only one to be burned by interest rates going up. This is affecting the economy. The Silicon Valley Bank collapsed. Part of the story there is We've got lots of cash on hand. We're going to put it into these, at the time, low-yielding treasury bonds. Interest rates go up. They're in effect. They've got lots of money sunk into these low-yield investments that could have been doing a lot better. That was part of the story of what went wrong, as I understand it. Is that bank collapse and another one a concern, a red flag for the rest of the economy?
I think the part of it is that when interest rates are low, as you know, typically, you know, coming out of recessions and so on, when we've seen that over the majority of, you know, since the Great Recession till about 2014, 2015, interest rates are pretty low and the Fed started raising interest rates. One of the things that we see banks and other institutions try and do is obviously they're not getting a big return from these like low interest assets. And so there's some incentive to try and get higher returns, but there's also a higher risk in those things. The thing with Silicon Valley, obviously, that happened was that as the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates, then the value of the assets on their balance sheets actually fell, because, of course, with higher interest rate, there's an inverse relationship between the price of those assets and the return on those assets, right? So on the balance sheet, the value of their assets sort of essentially not depreciated, but it fell, and that kind of caused them to seek funds, and then they ended up where they were. The big thing for the Federal Reserve at the time and the U.S. economy for other policymakers was to make sure that this wasn't a systemic event and that it didn't spread to other banks, because obviously people would lose confidence in the banking system. There could be a lot of bank runs, and as people try to pull out the money, and that would have a big impact on financial markets. And so part of the reason why the Fed did what they did, and the FDIC obviously stepped in to try and shore up the banks and make sure that it didn't create a bank run on other banks and you know, make uncertainty a lot bigger. So, I think a large part is that we really saw the two big banks, Silicon Valley Bank and then Signature Bank. Actually, I guess it was about a month ago. They're taken over by the FDIC, and then thankfully it didn't spread to other banks that were in trouble. And one of the things that we've seen is that since the financial crisis of 2007-2009, that banks typically have to, they are stress tested, and there's a bigger capital requirements for them, just in the case of bank runs and so on. And so there's different scenarios that have played out. I think especially in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, the Federal Reserve was trying to tell them you need to do better, but some of that advice wasn't taken on board, I guess. So yeah, and they ended up where they are. But yeah, I think, but it's certainly a thing that policymakers are keeping an eye on, and the Federal Reserve especially, on financial markets, and make sure that there isn't a systemic risk. Sorry.
And Yemen, there's one more thing that actually led me to have us want to call you. OPEC Plus now, yes. Saudi Arabia led, yes. Plus Russia. They cut production some on oil. Now, I'm looking at a big long-term oil cost chart. I wouldn't want to ride that roller coaster. There's a lot of headlines about this cut. It bumped prices up a little, but it didn't seem too shocking. What do you make of that?
I think part of it is because when we see, so if you're looking at your gas prices this past week, they went up a bit. I think a large part is that there's a couple of things that have been happening over the last, I guess 5 to 10 years, maybe structurally. I think people have been seeing higher gas prices, and so there's expenditure switching effect. So trying to find alternatives that are cheaper for them. That's part of why some of that price impact maybe didn't have quite as effect. But the other thing is that there's in the news, there's already been a lot of news about high inflation. And so part of when we see this happening with OPEC, some of that was already sort of incorporated in the price already, if you will. So it's good and bad news, because I would have actually expected there to be more of a change, than more of an impact than what did happen. But it could also indicate that, you know, the market has kind of realized that we're in high inflation territory, and the effects of those higher inflation terms, you know, has kind of already been passed on to prices already. So they may not be as quite as big an impact.
Yeah, we covered a lot of ground today. We'll leave it there. Sure. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much, friend. Appreciate it.
That's Yaman Ahmad, professor of economics at UW-Whitewater. He was with us to talk about the latest U.S. employment numbers, what they mean for inflation, the Federal Reserve's next move on interest rates, gas, and lots more. If there's a part of the economy you want to hear more about, let us know. And how it affects you in particular, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear what's on your mind and maybe see if we can tackle it in a future conversation here on Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a former Olympic runner shares some behind-the-scenes scandals with issues of doping, abuse, and more in a high-profile training program. Meet the author of the new book, The Longest Race, to get the story behind those scandals, how it affected the sport, and you can join in with your own questions for the author. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. So I'm working in my office this afternoon and I hear some hullabaloo outside my office window. I looked out and down and saw a small crowd of people on the fourth floor landing of the building, each of them armed with a sword and a dagger. But don't be alarmed. That's the kind of thing that happens when you share a building with a university theater department. It looked like they were training for some theatrical fight choreography. I don't know if it was a class or the company for an upcoming play. First thing they did was put down their weapons and did some unarmed work on stances and lunges. Then came the swords, then the two-weapon work. Now, of course, maybe I misread the whole situation and the Montagues were down there getting ready for some trouble with the Capulets. But soft, what fight through yonder window breaks? This is Central Time.